Hello, and Merry Christmas, listeners. It's Sam, welcoming you to a special holiday hangover bonus episode of Know Your Enemy. Matt is still down in Pennsylvania with his teetotaling parents, probably white-knuckling it through day five or six of no bourbon, but I'm still here in New York City, the den of sin, having spent the holiday in my bed with a very mild case of COVID-19. During my convalescence, I've been thinking a lot about a certain Jewish holy man who's brought me and Matt, and maybe you, a great deal of comfort in our lives. He's not from the Middle East, but the Midwest, and his name is Bob Dylan. As you may know or assume, Matt and I are big apologists for Dylan's late 70s Christian rock records, and so we were thrilled in April 2022 to be invited on the wonderful Jokerman podcast to discuss Dylan's gospel era with the Jokerman themselves, Ian and Evan. And I thought, while you, dear listener, are eating leftover ham or sneaking off to your childhood bedroom to hide from your family and take furtive hits from your weed pen, you also might enjoy listening to that conversation we had with Ian and Evan about Dylan's Christian era. Now, if you hate it when we talk about Bob on Know Your Enemy, you won't enjoy this at all. But for everyone else, why don't you sit back, relax, and take a few minutes on this day after Christmas to contemplate the man who came and died a criminal's death. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, we love you, enjoy.
Welcome back. It's Jokerman Podcast. I'm Evan.
I'm Ian. And today we're joined. Today's a Jokerman foursome. I guess this isn't the most people. This is a tide for the most people that we've ever had on the show at one time. So we're gonna have to wrangle everyone here. We're joined by two other professional podcasters, knowers and scholars of the conservative movement over the last century. They're here to discuss conservative artist Bob Dylan. Sam and Matt from Know Your Enemy.
Hey, happy to be here. I'm really excited to talk about right-wing religious fanatic Bob Dylan.
Fantastic.
Just to be clear, you're both conservatives, and that's how you identify.
Yeah, no, Bob's sort of a scion of the conservative movement. That's why we are so attached to him.
Beautiful. Well, you have come to the right place because we're big fans of Bob. I'm not even going to bother making a joke about Neighborhood Bully. Okay. We'll leave that aside for the time being.
Don't touch that dial if you're concerned that these people are actually going to be espousing right wing views. Know that these are two left. I would say you're slightly left of center, and that you actually you spend your time on your podcast, Know Your Enemy, analyzing and knowing the right wing contingency and
the titular enemy,
the enemy. Yeah.
That's correct. I think Sam and I would both call ourselves socialists, and our podcast is dedicated to looking at the right, as you said. So
there you go.
Just a little comedy to get us started.
Yeah.
You may know this, but Matt actually was a conservative, which will probably come up about his appreciation for Bob from his youth. So we'll get the perspective of a conservative.
So did you kind of, when you were in that era, Matt, did you kind of like hate Bob Dylan as like the symbol of like lefty 60s counterculture sort of shit?
No, it was crazy. Even in high school, it's when I became a big Dylan fan. And I just always loved Bob. And even if the politics, first of all, they were elusive enough in some ways. I guess some of the early protest songs, you know, you can figure out maybe what the cash out would be in that context.
Sure.
But I never like had a conservative dislike of Bob or like a skepticism towards him in that sense. And in fact, like his Christian stuff, which we're going to talk about, was some of the stuff of his I loved the most.
Yeah.
And I discovered it like at that time too. So it's interesting because so much of it kind of passed the smell test for me as like a true believer, 17-year-old, fundamentalist Christian in central Pennsylvania.
Well, I mean, it's that tracks because if you go to a Bob Dylan show, there is no real like one type of person there at all. It's
not,
like, yeah, so
not just
broad.
One type of guy.
There is an infinite array of people who are interested in Bob Dylan. And, of course, that speaks directly to your experience here, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. Although, the first time I saw Bob, he was touring with Phil Lesh. And so it was kind of the Deadhead crowd there. And that that was a surprise to my, like, 18-year-old self. Like, I just didn't know people like that.
So, didn't know those,
like,
people existed.
The people in the parking lot being like, hey, man, want to buy a grilled cheese? I got to make to one more show. I was just like, you know, I don't know what to do with that.
Now he only knows people like that.
Now I'm the guy selling the grilled cheese.
Right. Well, it's like the Change trilogy. That's something we discuss here on the podcast.
You can't expect them to know what that is.
Well, that's what I'm going to explain. It's the cycle of songs. Things have changed.
The times are changing,
and I feel a change coming on from Bob Dylan's great 2009 album, Together Through Life. They kind of feed into one another. So that experience, that's a perfect
example.
You're
really shoehorning in the Change trilogy.
You gotta drop the branded stuff where you can. Yeah. Sam, what about you? How did you kind of get started with Bob?
Yeah, much more typical passage. My parents are like, you know, boomers who loved Bob, and I listened to them in my home and appreciated him. Though, I mean, I think that, like, there's probably a pretty common experience with, like, you know, people who were raised by, like, middle-class liberals where they liked certain Bob stuff, and then, you know, and then I, like, at some point later in life realized, like, wow, there's all this other...
It's all
really
good. It's all good music.
First of all, it's all good, yeah. And then also, like, it's so much weirder than I thought.
Yes.
And so, yeah, my it's actually insane. I've been thinking about this listening to some of your guys' episodes, too. It's insane how you can keep liking Bob more.
Yeah, it's true. And this is, I don't know if we've even mentioned what we're talking about today yet, but we're talking about the bootleg series number
13. Lucky 13, number 13.
Trouble No More, which, I mean, if we're going to talk about the mystery that is liking Bob more despite the things he does,
yeah,
the ways he is, or because of them, then this is this is the perfect example, because this is the Born Again era in its live glory.
Live outtakes, and rehearsals, studio, yeah. Radio spots. This is for the real sickos. Like, it is.
It's actually not for sickos, Ian. This is for people who are stop being sickos.
Right. Good point. For the people who are keeping track of all the sickos out there.
That cartoon meme of the sicko guy going, yes, yes. This is him having a moment where he goes, why am I outside this window creeping on somebody? Shouldn't I be thinking about my impact on the people around me?
That's a great point.
Shouldn't I be reflecting upon my life?
Shouldn't I be concerned about my eternal soul?
Yeah,
right.
And that the man who came and died a prisoner's death.
There you go.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You didn't mention him, did you?
Yeah.
So hopefully by the end of this, we all will be reformed sickos.
Yeah, that's the idea. I know there's at least I'm not much of a religious person. I don't know about you guys, Sam and Matt, but something tells me that neither of you are particularly devout.
Here's where you're wrong.
Maybe I'm wrong. That's why
you hear about New York podcaster socialists and you think they're all the same. They're
godless. Godless materialists. No, I am practicing Catholic.
Oh, wow. Okay. Hell yeah.
I take it pretty seriously. I mean, you know, I'm not, I wouldn't claim devout. I'm a bad enough person. I wouldn't claim that.
Sure.
But I wanted to say too, since we're going into the Bob, I mentioned, you know, so I grew up like a fundamentalist Baptist where the end time stuff, which I'm sure we'll get to, is really, you know, it was a huge part of my religious upbringing. So that kind of stuff, when Bob's like the little, you know, sermons before a song or even just the themes of some of these, it really, like I said, when I first listened to it, it really hit home. But yeah, now I'm Catholic. I've had my own religious journey, you might say.
Wonderful.
But one of the things I wanted to say about, too, like, high school era Bob listening was I was really into the bootleg scene. And my best friend in high school, Adam, had a huge collection. And so this was like early, like late 90s, early 2000s. Like you would burn the CDs and like share your list with other people.
Glory
and
days.
Somehow he got a copy, a video of the Toronto 1980 stuff.
Oh.
So incredible. That was like, I think one reason I love this era of Bob so much is not just the albums, which I really loved, especially Shot of Love, but I had those Toronto recordings where Bob was like, you had
on fire,
you know, yeah, so just like the amazing cooking band, like Bob out there dancing sometimes, taking the mic off the mic stand, just dancing, and the black backup singers, the gospel singers in the background. It was really like quite a scene, and I think seeing those videos early on really, I don't know, just kind of cemented my love for this era.
I feel like
Bob.
That's also really helpful for not like developing what seemed like for like a while, like the, I don't know if it was the critical consensus or just like the fan consensus that like this was a bad era of Bob.
Right.
Like I feel like
More critical, but yeah.
Like we're doing, I mean, obviously you guys on your podcast and hopefully on this one too, will be doing the work of reviving the greatness of the Christian era. But like if you had seen that, because I literally like right before we started recording, I was watching the What Can I Do For You from that Toronto
show. That one's beautiful.
It is so gorgeous. The harmonica playing solo is pristine. It's so amazing. What can I do for you? And yeah, if you saw that, you wouldn't be like, this must have been in a low point for Bob.
No, no. It really comes down to ideological stuff, I think. And I hope that's what we'll hope to get into on this episode of Joker Men as we, I guess, now's a good time as any to honk on Bobo.
Honked. Yeah, that's a great point, I think, is just like kind of the cultural scene in which this was taking place in, because, you know, listening back to this stuff, you know, and like also we've been super deep into Street Legal over the last couple months as well. Like, wow. I feel like the, you know, that 78 to 83, like up until Infidels period, like really has been represented. It's like a fallow period for Bob. But like, honestly, like it feels to me like this is like the high, like one of the absolute high points of his entire
It really
kind of
is
journey.
Like kind of a centerpiece moment of his career.
Yeah.
And it's like, if you think about the breakup of his marriage, I mean, it's like a huge, huge event in his life. And the way that Bob Dylan deals with that is to do this.
Is to become a hardcore fire and brimstone evangelical preacher and start basically heckling all of his audiences into becoming believers in the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ.
Well, I will say I love Street Legal too.
Yes, like, you're speaking our language. You love Shot of Love. You love Street Legal. You're speaking our language.
Here. And I've always personally like heard a lot of continuity between Street Legal and what came after, in a way.
Sure.
Like, I'm not surprised by it. I don't know what you guys have said all about it on your podcast, but to me, it's just, yeah, I love that album too. And I just feel like it's all of a piece in some way.
Totally.
Like, I've always thought of it as an era too. I'm just agreeing with you, really.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at the end of Street Legal, right, the last song, Dark Heat, he's saying, I can't believe it. I can't believe I'm alive, but without you, it just doesn't seem right. Oh, where are you tonight? Like, he's a man, like, at the end of his rope, he's lost. Like, his whole future is black in front of him. So it makes complete sense that the next record, the next song you hear, got to serve somebody. Well, he's got a whole new fucking thing.
I mean, it makes sense, but it's also kind of remarkable that there was an X record, and it was. I mean, where do you go from there? It is kind of like this sea change moment, I suppose, in Bob's creative life, where, as we talked about like a million times on the show, there are like a few other points like this along his career where he seems to like go into a cocoon and then like come back out later. And he did, I suppose, gravitate to the Lord in this particular instance, whereas at other points it was like gravitating back to the roots of his earliest folk music inclinations. What was the other one? I don't know. The other time when he did that.
There have been many.
Oh, right? Yeah. Of course, the Sinatra era like stuff. Yeah. That's
the
like Blues another.
Men, you know, the 2000s. It's, you know, he's always becoming in the process of, you know, he not busy being born is busy dying. You may have heard that somewhere, Evan.
Uh-huh. I've never heard that.
Yeah. Opens your eyes.
Before.
Part of what I've also always found fascinating, and Sam, and I don't know if you guys have like experience listening to like punk and new wave, because I'm sure you do, and Evan and I do as well. But like what's so fascinating about this particular turn of Bob's is that like this is the direction he's going as like things like punk and hip hop and disco and like these real kind of like, you know, what seemed at the time to be quote unquote dangerous kind of musical movements were kind of coming to the forefront, and the classic rockers, the boomer generation that Bob came out of and was kind of the vanguard of, fading into the background, getting kind of fat and happy, you know, touring, making a lot of money, but they're past their artistic primes. If you guys have any thoughts about just that kind of mismatch or match, you know, so
yeah.
to speak.
Well, I think that's such an interesting question, because I always think, like, is this like, you could look back at this era and think he's like preempting like the Reagan era and kind of like this conservative turn in American politics and culture, Bob with his sort of like fox-like sense of where America is headed, kind of goes there before the rest of the culture turns that way, and that this is some kind of like part of the reactionary backlash to the 60s and 70s era. But I think that's wrong, because this is very challenging music in a way. Like, he's putting a challenge to his listeners. And in fact, a lot of them get upset. You know, they're like, fuck you, we don't want to do this. And so there's part of it where I think, like, Matt and I, like, in our... Matt and I listened to a ton of this stuff the other night and had a lot of, I'm sure, very profound conversations, most of which I forget, because
he should have just recorded those. And
he provided extremely good bourbon to accompany this, and now I forget everything that we talked about, but I'm sure it was good. But one of the things,
Sam, you were brilliant.
Oh, thank you. But now I'm not going to be able to live up to that now. But I think one thing that I was a takeaway is like. The difference between this kind of evangelicalism that Bob gets invested in this moment, and the evangelicalism of the new right and of Reagan, mm-hmm. Like the first evangelical president was not Reagan; it was Carter. Carter was a deeply believing Christian, won the South,
friends with Bob. Like,
close friends with Bob, exactly. Yep. And I think that their variety of sort of like Christian nationalism was actually much more similar than Bob's and Reagan's, for
Interesting.
Example.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, Carter's like the rock and roll Christian president.
Right.
That's what he is. You know, he's like, there's like his son smoking weed with Willie Nelson, like on the roof of the White House or whatever. And like... And Carter's like Christian message was this very demanding, self-abnegating kind of message. Like, the reason everybody ended up hating Carter was because there was like a recession and a gas crisis, and he would go on TV and be like, look,
turn down your thermostats.
turn down your thermostats, tighten your belts.
Put on your cardigan.
Yeah, put on your cardigan and take some responsibility for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
He said the thing that was like true, and they hated him for it.
They hated him for
people
it.
People don't
want
to hear that.
Yeah. You know, he's like reading Christopher Lash and giving the crisis of confidence speech. Like, this is a very different version of Christian kind of public speaking. And then, and Bob, too, like, this isn't Christianity as, like, everything's fine, this is an easy solution to all your problems.
Right.
This is Christianity as, like, you have to take you have to account for yourself, account for your life. You have to serve somebody, and you have to, you know, this is a demanding version of what of sort of Christian belief and faith.
Right.
It's not this kind of like thing like, oh, it's so easy, all the answers are obvious. And with Reagan, you get a much more absolving version of Christianity.
It's just the forgiveness part.
It's all the forgiveness part. Reagan, we had
well, for some people.
Yeah, right. Well, friend, yeah. Right. Only for some, right. Right. But we have a friend of the pod, Rick Perlstein, who's written all these books about the conservative movement, and he has this great line about Reagan is that Reagan articulates a liturgy of absolution. And it's all about how America is great. It's always been great. You're great because you're American. All these leftists have been telling you that you're bad because you're American. America does bad things in the world. No, that's not true. America is great. You're great exactly the way you are. And that's his version of Christian, you know, evangelism. And
sure.
And Bob's is way more like, I was saying to Matt earlier that Bob's like the you know, this era is like the soundtrack to the second Carter administration that never happened.
It's really
which would have been a disaster too.
But you say that because I was thinking about how that the boomers basically are this thing of a convergence of the hippie instinct,
yeah.
Yes. And also conservatism at the same time, and so. It makes perfect sense considering that Bob hated the hippies, was like found them to be basically like repugnant
and hypocrites,
hypocrite, indulgent freaks who were trying to literally coming up to his doorstep as he was trying to live a normal life in Woodstock, New York with his family. Yeah. And, you know, touting him as like the savior of whatever. This thing that was impressed upon him, I think, a deep distaste for that sort of flavor of the month quality. And then I think Reagan, it seems like those hippies that had essentially conservative leanings just kind of adapted to whatever the 80s would represent as the new flavor of the month of it's not being a hippie now, it's being more of like a yuppie, it's being like a member of like the suave elite business class, and you know how to have a good time. And yes. I think all of this is what he's condemning, is the type of person that is malleable enough and lacks the self-awareness to find themselves just shifting and moving with whatever the breeze tells you that day.
Right.
Uh-huh. Although I would say, I think that's right, Evan, but there is also this like California religious sensibility to the context. Yes. Bob was in. And,
totally.
And also, I mean, this kind of gets to Sam's point that we think of, like when we talk about evangelical Christianity, we tend to think of Jerry Falwell, the moral majority, right? Not the Jimmy Carters of the world. But like before that time, it was really, I think, especially in the late 60s and 70s, there was a real, like a guy like Larry Norman, who was like a Christian rock singer-songwriter who, I think one of his albums was called like, We're Only Here Visiting or something like that. Like, We're Only Here Visiting Planet Earth. But like he, you know, or even like more popularly, he was Jewish, but the song kind of had Christian resonances, like Larry, what was his name? Norman Greenbaum, Spirit in the Sky, you know, that song from like late 60s.
Great song.
Like this stuff was all in the air, and Bob was in California, and this Vineyard Christian Fellowship, which was like his religious community, was, you know, it had, I think, a bit of that like seeker, not like flabby, you know, self-indulgent hippiness, but a sort of, you know, seeker California. It was very interpersonal. Like Bob did small Bible studies and took classes with the pastors, and it, you know, that kind of intentional evangelical community was a big part of it. And I was telling Sam earlier, reading some of the Clinton Halen book Behind the Shades from this period, I didn't realize like another early convert, even preceding Baum, I think, to this Vineyard Christian Fellowship was T-Bone Burnett. He was in like the worship band, right? Yeah. And so it,
like a great like, church band, I bet.
Yeah, and I think even some people who might have been touring band. With Bob.
Yeah, Keltner, you know, were, Keltner was
Jim
involved.
Jim Keltner so, as well. Was, yeah. Yeah.
And I think still, I don't know if it's still like is, specifically think, with this one particular sect, he's but still Christian. Is very, you know, devout.
Yeah, yeah. So great there's player. Just a lot of like in the 70s, like Christian folk, Christian rock, like evangelical Christianity was not as associated with like hard right politics. There was a kind of like hippie Jesus freak, Jesus people, yeah. you know, thing going on too. And so I just think, yeah, to look back and view the context in which Bob converted kind of, you know, retrospectively as very right wing conservative, there might have been aspects of that, but. I don't think that really captures the whole picture.
Yeah, I think that totally makes sense. And the analogy, or not analogy, but the comparison with something like Falwell, right, or like Jim Baker, or right down to like the Righteous mm-hmm. Gemstones, right? Like the common like modern conception of evangelical, you know, whatever. There's like a really commercial element to it, right? And this, uh-huh. what Bob is doing, this is like the opposite of commercial. He's willingly like not like giving his audience yeah. the furthest thing from what they want. He's playing just 100% Christian music at these shows, at least in 79 and 80. Yeah. And just basically torching his entire commercial career
but at
to
the same
follow
time,
his
though,
muse it, here.
He, this is the same guy who like not that long before was like a young man singing flesh colored Christ that glow in the dark, it's easy to see without looking too far, and not much is really sacred. That he was like doing these sort of torch just like torching everything type songs that were like everything is terrible, and that's like the instinct from which I think it was like fertile ground for something more substantive to come in. He was already distrustful of the world. And I think what he lacked was a feeling of something to fill that void. And with, you know, maybe the dissolution of his marriage, it's like, well, there uh-huh. has to be something more here. And religion is, for many people, the answer for that, answer. That searching, that question.
Yeah, but it's also so fascinating in a lot of these songs how women appear as figures in them.
Yeah, right? Totally.
And even Bob's own ability to, like, manipulate other people.
Ain't gonna go to hell for anybody.
Yeah,
that's one of the. If we best are going to talk about a song, might as well start with that one. That's like the standout highlight. Love that song.
But I don't know a Santa Bond and the old dance control to gain the whole world and lose my soul. I ain't gonna go to hell for anybody.
I cannot believe they left it off a record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. Well, I mean, that was one of the songs I had listed to talk about, partly because, you know, it shows up twice in the box set. Once on disc two, like from April, Montreal, April 1980, and then later in Salem, Oregon, that at the very end of the year, December 1980. And the mm-hmm. two versions are so different. The first one begins with the great, just the backup gospel singers, you know, all
coming in one by one.
Coming in one by one. And then, like, the guitar coming in. And then, you know, it building to, like, the song, mm-hmm. like, finally starting. And then the second one, the later one, it's much more, it just begins with a guitar. It doesn't begin with the gospel singers. So it's also kind of amazing, like, for listeners to the podcast, like, just listening to those two things separated by, like, 8 months or something. It's an incredible example of how Bob reworks songs while he's on the road, too. In addition to being an amazing song. That first one in April.
I mean, that
really
first version is like
on
like
fire.
My goodness. Yeah.
If you're going to, I mean, I'm attached a bit to that version just because it's so, so great.
it really is.
The way that, yeah, as you said, it like builds in that like extremely dramatic way at the beginning. And there's just the song, like, I think I first heard it like 3 years ago or something. It's so wild. It's like something about that song just like it's almost too direct. Like, it's arresting. Yeah. It's like disarming. I mean, like, how direct it is. It's just like, I'm not going to go to hell for anybody. The actual implications of that are so, it goes like really deep.
Well, I think who says, like, it starts with the chorus, but the first, who says I can manipulate people as well as anybody?
Right. Yeah.
I know all the angles, know how to make a game go. I can make believe I'm in love with almost anybody.
Yeah, that line is incredible.
Hold them and control them, tease them and squeeze them. Yeah, but it's like, but also like, that's like, this is one of the things I was thinking about a lot too, is like the relationship between, so many of Bob's songs are so mean and angry about like other people,
right?
And like just nailing them to rights. You know, like Rolling Stone and like the, you know, Positively Fourth Street, these sort of songs that just kind of like are like, this is what's wrong with you, and this is how you've wronged me, and it's so clear, and I'm going to articulate it in this like just damning way. And I think one of the interesting things about the Christian era, if we're speaking of its positive qualities, is like, he does implicate himself a lot.
Totally.
You know? I can manipulate people as well as anybody. You know, it's like, yeah, I know what you mean, Evan, that it's like, it's almost like, don't say that to me. Like, that's too honest. Like, when somebody says something to you and you're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, I'm sure that's true, but you shouldn't say that.
As a Sagittarius, I think that I resonate with that sort of blunt honesty. That
you're bringing pagan Zoroastrianism into this conversation about the Lord, Evan. That has no place here.
Wait, Evan, I think I was listening to the pod at some point, and you said the line, I'm a 5'7 Sagittarius like Cassavetes.
Yeah, that's right. That gives me some kind of feeling of hope in my darkest moments.
Cassavetes gives all of us short kings hope.
Well, you know who else is 5'7?
Bob Dylan.
Well, you know, Evan, it's interesting, even going back to some of what was mentioned earlier, the, like, Bob converting, it's interesting to think about it as giving him a new way to write about himself, as Sam's kind of getting at, right? Like, especially, like, post, you know, if you can look at his early years and say this is like a young man's, right, like, grappling with the world, the anger, the injustice, whatever.
And with women, like, Blonde on women, Blonde.
Yeah,
exactly.
And then, like, Blood on the Tracks, the divorce album. Like, if you're going to keep writing about yourself, you need a new vantage point from which to do so, in a way. And I think the religious material, as Sam's getting at, the more self-lacerating, self-critical aspect, like, it gave Bob's writing about himself, like, both new material and, I think, a certain, you know, in the Rolling Stone review of Slow Train Coming, right? Like, authenticity was the word. Yeah, the winner used.
Yeah. Well, and he's earnest with it.
Yeah, but I think, like, that was actually a perceptive review to point that out. And I think it's real. And I think it's, like, the richness of this material comes from that, like, Bob was writing about himself from a genuinely fresh perspective.
Yeah, it's a
religious perspective.
It's a perspective that, you know, another Dylan line comes to mind. I'm trying to get as far away from myself as I can from later on, where I feel like that's what he's trying to do here, in a way where it's like the freshness that he was seeking came from a perspective where maybe, I mean, couldn't speak from any personal experience, but if you were to have a relationship breakup, then you might be feeling a bit inclined to be self-lacerating, to turn things upon yourself and feel like, what did I do wrong? And I think religion, in this case, it's like with the Christianity, it was kind of like a way for him to sublimate those feelings of potential personal failure in a relationship into something where it's not just me, it's all of us, it's everyone. Actually is always messing up.
And it gives you,
it's my job I have the platform to tell you.
Yeah.
There's also a weird way in which, like, back to our comments about street legal, you know, like, the imagery for the church in Christian theology is as the bride of Christ. And so, like, think back to street legal, the groom still waiting at the altar. Like there's all, like, as a Christian, I first heard that song and thought, he's clearly, there's something here. I don't know if that's true or not,
But it wasn't Groomsteel. We have to do a nerdy correction. Groomsteeling the Altar is from, it's from a different one, right?
Shot of Love.
It's not from Street
Shot of Love.
Shot of Love.
Oh, crap. Oh, never
but
mind.
Cut this out then. It's a, no, it's a really weird song that doesn't belong on any album.
The point I was driving at is there's a really interesting way in which like women in as like figures in Christian theology, there's a lot of, I felt like some of these songs, like, who is Bob talking to or addressing?
Can we talk about Precious Angel then?
I was about to say we should talk about Precious Angel.
I mean, what another song. Standout. I mean, probably my top favorite, just bar none favorite song from the era. I think it's so
good.
I love it. It's so good. But that thing does pop up in every time I listen to it, and that and like Covenant Woman, like there's all it's like the women in these songs are very different than the women in Blonde on Blonde. That's so vastly different, and even different from the women in Blood on the Tracks, which was like he does seem to create a more three-dimensional view of the women in his life as he goes on. But then it actually becomes weirdly abstracted in this material. Mm-hmm. The women are like, you don't know if he's dating, you don't know if he's with them, if they're his, like, if it's an angel or if it is an actual person, or some combination of the two. And the lyrics kind of like play around with that willy nilly. You never really know who these women are.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is him trying to write about Sarah, his ex-wife at this point, without like pointedly writing about Sarah specifically. There's one of these tracks on here. I culled out a bunch of lyrics from some of these songs just to run through with everyone at some point. But one of these songs is just a cover, it's Help Me Understand. Which is just some random song. It's the divorce song, exactly. Yeah. You know she didn't ask to be brought to this world to drift from pillar to post. This is talking about the daughter in this song. But a divorce never stops to consider the ones it hurts the most, as in this unfair divorce that Bob has gone through is harming all of his children.
It's like you didn't think of it. It's just like the divorce court song.
It's the most father's rights track in his entire discography.
There's that one and Let's Stick Together, the cover of Let's Stick Together.
Right.
Did.
Yeah.
Well, the marriage vow is very sacred. Great song.
And so that one, I mean, you can see why he left on the cutting room floor, obviously, because that's a little on the nose. But I think
Let's Stick Together is. That's
well, no, 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 but Help Me Understand, is on the cutting room floor. It just pops up here because it's a little on the nose. But I think a lot of the other women that he's writing about a little more kind of obscurely or obtusely, I think a lot of the stuff that he had gone through with his ex-wife at this point was informing those views, those statements, those lyrics, the kind of attitude towards women that comes through here at this moment in time.
I think Matt's also right, though, that like the Christian kind of idiom gives him a way to situate women in his life in a way that's like not either as like ideal love objects or as like his tormentors. Like Precious Angel is like she's the medium through which he has access to God.
Sure. You're my woman, like, you're my delight.
She showed him, you know, she showed him that he was blind, you know. That's like a you could still see it as like an instrumentalist approach to his relationships with women, but it's one where woman is like the conduit between him and the divine.
Yes, and to the extent it's instrumentalized, I mean, that would be my take on the way they're instrumentalized in some of this stuff. And in fact, we know like his joining the Vineyard Christian Fellowship partly came through a black actress named Mary Alice Artez, mm-hmm. right? And so, like, there is a, and this is a kind of common story, like men finding religion because of someone they're dating or their marriage. You know,
isn't like Justin Bieber a member of like the a similar type of?
He's a member of Hillsong,
right?
Which is like originally based out of Australia, but it's really geared around like these, like the worship music from Hillsong churches is like a huge deal. It's like very like rock music, like energetic praise music.
So this is the equivalent, the modern, current day equivalent to the Vineyard.
I mean, obviously, if, like, T-Bone Burnett is in this, like, worship band, like, yeah.
Now we just have Justin Bieber and I guess, his wife.
But there is especially, like, a man trying to clean himself up and meets a good woman who introduces him to religion. That's a thing, you know? Yeah. And it was a thing for Bob. And I think, as Sam's saying, the Christian idiom, like, the figures of women in his songs in the spirit are really interesting. But but it's kind of complicated, and you know, maybe you see some of that instrumentalization in, you know, like, women being a conduit in some way for, like, his experience of the divine.
It's interesting now that, like, where do women factor into his songwriting now? Because earlier on, like you go early enough, it's like it's sort of abstract. It's like he's literally covering songs that are just about the idea of women. Then he's writing songs about women who have harmed him or like he has problems with.
Haven't lived up to his expectations.
That then goes deeper and deeper. And then he's talking about how he's failed with women or they've failed each other. And then it goes into this nebulous sort of like women as religious conduit phase. And then now it's like he's writing when he writes about women. I mean, even the song, like I've made up my mind to give myself to you. It feels like it is like a devotional song that does not really talk about who it is at all. That subject is assumed to be a woman. He says, I'll go far away from home with her. But it is kind of this abstracted woman again. And yet it seems to incorporate the depth of the entire career and his relationship to women through song in this way that's like very profound.
I love that song.
Mysterious. At this
beautiful
point.
I love that song. And I so I think like in the Christian era, always with religious music, and this is just kind of like we should probably talk about this at some point. Like the thing about religious music and rock music is that it's just the same thing, and like there's always this thing where it's like, are they talking about Jesus? Are they talking about God? Or are they talking about someone they want to fuck?
Yeah.
and so that's always there. It's like, who is the you in this song? Who is the person I'm longing for? Who is the person I'm going to be loyal to? Who is the person I feel like I'm betraying? But what's so fascinating about I Made My Mind to Give Myself to You, I had not had this thought. I went to the show, one of the shows at the Beacon last year.
Oh, we were there too.
We were there too. Oh, yeah. I was at two of three.
I don't remember which night I was there, but I brought my girlfriend, who is a big Bob fan but had never seen him. And she was totally blown away, which was great.
You have a girlfriend who is a big Bob fan?
That's the dream, isn't it?
That's revolutionary.
Like, I have to make sure not to make it into one of my annoying obsessions so that it then becomes like unattractive to her. Like she on her own.
They're just
Bob.
Like, I like him.
Yeah, he's pretty cool.
You could put on Bob if you want. So she came to the show. And when he played that song, I was like, isn't that a beautiful song? And then afterwards, we were talking about it, and she said, yeah. And it was so obvious that he was talking to the audience.
Yeah,
he was saying, I've made up my mind to give myself to you.
Well, there was the thing that there was like a clip that was circulating on Bob Twitter where he is playing that song, and somebody in the crowd in the middle of like a short pause says, we love you, Bob. And then he like laughs. And he says, and he emphasizes very distinctly the final lines of I've made up my mind to give myself to you. And that actually tracks perfectly because I hadn't thought about that until I heard that clip. And then it's like, oh.
Yeah. So I think like what's so fascinating about him is that, like, you know, through all these relationships and these all these kind of like trying to figure out how he should relate to people that he cares about and love, and who he has an obligation to, who he's loyal to. Of course, like, the thing what's so fascinating is, like, Bob obviously resents his audience. He also loves them. I was saying to Matt the other night, like there's like this Freudian insight. Matt's going to roll his eyes because I'm always talking about Freud. He's always talking about Catholic shit, and I'm always talking about Freud. That's the Jewish Catholic breakdown of the podcast.
Great dynamic.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But so
what we have in common is profound guilt. We share that. That's what we all have in common.
So there's this great Freudian insight, which the opposite of love is not hate; it's indifference. Mm. Love and hate are in some kind of like complicated relationship with each other because ambivalence.
Sucks.
No, it's true though. So like, if you are capable of hating something, it's closer to love than indifference.
Yeah. Right.
And Bob goes through all of these periods where he's like trying to decide how he feels about the people who love him, his audience, like his admirers, and I feel like that song is like, in a similar way, the like apostrophe of to the you is like to this constant sometimes tormenting, but often the only like true and full relationship in his life, which is with the people who love his music.
Well I think that makes perfect sense. If just to vindicate a controversial point we've made many times on the show, is like the period, specifically the album that we have always felt was the weakest, is New Morning. And I think that if you read Chronicles, you will find that is the album where every hint points to that it's the one time when he seemed to feel indifferent about his audience. He just wanted to put out a record and they put a record out. Mm. And I think that makes it a weak record in this way that is maybe hard to pin down, but I think you maybe have gotten towards something there, because that's unusual for him to just be like, let's just put something out. I'm focused on something else.
I'm not trying to antagonize them or please them.
Yeah. Well, now it's like, I mean, the man he's just announced new tour dates. And I mean, the gravity of that is not
unstoppable.
Shouldn't be lost on anyone. It's just like, the man is near, you know, statistically the end of his life, and he is choosing to spend it doing this. And that is just really, like,
bonkers.
Insane.
Well, it's the never-ending tour. It's,
it really never is going to end.
Yeah.
It's never going to end as long as he can has any say.
Yeah. Well, you know, one question about the audience, or one point to make. One of the tracks on the box set, the deluxe box set, is the radio spot.
Oh, so good.
And which I just kind of feel like, in this context, especially the preceding, you know, comments from Sam and Evan, like, deserves to be unpacked, because you start listening to it and it's, you know, you hear some music, but then the first like couple people talking are just saying like, man, I came to hear Bob Dylan and I got preaching instead, or like, I you know, and then you have some other people are like, I liked it. You know, it's like an extremely weird radio spot, but like, talking about Bob's relationship to his fans, I just thought of that extremely weird. It's one of the tracks on the box set. It's this radio spot from like a show in Oregon or something.
Yep.
And it's just,
and like,
it's so
like
strange.
So familiar, right? Because it's like the same as like in No Direction Home.
Yeah, the British.
The Brits.
We thought he was going to do folk music. He came out and did all this pop stuff. Didn't want to hear this stupid pop band.
It was rubbish. It was rubbish. And I hated it.
Absolutely shite.
Bob Dylan is taking a slow train to Portland. His concert is January 10th, 8 p.m. at the Paramount.
I was kind of disappointed. I wanted to hear rock and roll. Rock and roll. I heard Bob Dylan singing gospel. I didn't come here to hear sermons. I could have went to church, man.
I want the old Bob Dylan, the one I know and love, and that wasn't him.
No, I think the message is the same one he sang about before. It's just more focused. I mean, people used to have to wonder about what he was saying. Now it's clear what he's saying.
Hey, he sounded great. The band was fine. The scriptures say to preach the gospel to the Gentiles, the kings, and the children of Israel. And that's just what he's doing.
Decide for yourself. Bob Dylan in concert, January 10th at the Paramount. Seating for the special event is reserved only. Tickets on sale now at Meyer Frank downtown and all the usual Paramount outlets.
I think you should put unplug that guitar and go home and do normal songs. But it is interesting that the people coming who were open to it, it's like, I wonder if they were probably people who didn't know that much about Bob Dylan. And they just know he's a big name. And then they come and they see obvious, like, just intense charisma and are moved by it, because you come to be entertained. Like, you'll be entertained by that show. I mean, if you're with it and you're paying attention, you can tell that he's attempting to communicate something. And I think rock music works best when the person doing it is actively attempting to communicate something. And when you're not doing that, I mean, we all love shoegaze music. We all like that. It's nice to hear, but it is not music often that is like, just, you know, a lot of indie rock, a lot of the last, you know, like 20 years, a lot of it falls victim of this thing of like, well, you don't really need to hear the lyrics. You don't really need to. It's more about the vibe and just like how it sounds. But
and feeling like you're inside the womb again.
Yeah, that's like a more, it's like a physical, it's almost like, that type of music is to what is closer to dance music, where it's for like a body feeling. It's for like this feeling of safety or you know, you're getting somehow intellectually stimulated.
It's like an indica versus sativa.
Right.
There you go.
Where this
I'm
stuff
speaking
is
Matt's
like
language.
It's like no weed. It is like a cold splash of water to the face. And you are either rejuvenated and refreshed, or you're very mad.
Well, I'd love to hear you talk. We should maybe talk about some more of the songs. I know everybody's probably got ones they want to talk about.
Yeah, what are your picks?
We could go around.
I mean, there's a million versions too.
Yeah. Well, there's one song. This wasn't first on my list, but to maybe mix things up a little bit, I didn't realize that. Unless you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the recording of Caribbean Wind, a disc two of this, is the only live recording we have.
I think officially released.
Officially released. And the other one, there was like a studio outtake that was on the early bootleg series, right?
On Biograph. The first one. From 85.
Yeah, and I don't know if that is like a cult favorite for you two or you, Sam. Sam and I, we've never talked about Caribbean Wind, but it was one of those ones that kind of stands out as like, oh, wow, there's this live version of Caribbean Wind. And it's such a, I've always thought it kind of an amazing song.
Yeah,
and,
I think it's a cool song.
Yeah. It's one of those ones you're like, how did this never end up on an album?
Yeah. That one definitely I was a late arrival to, but it is like one of my pantheon, like top level songs of all time of his at this point. And specifically really the Biograph version, which I think nails the kind of like glossy, fun, breezy 80s vibe that needs to go along with that song.
But it's got that onomatopoetic... The
actual whoosh of the Caribbean Wind. But yeah, I mean, the versions that we get here, I think there's two. There's a live version. There's also like a studio outtake or rehearsal or something like that. And they're very different, completely different sets of lyrics. This is a song in particular that like never actually finished becoming whatever it was supposed to be. Like he rewrote the song multiple times, different tempos, different instruments, different delivery styles and stuff like that. It's just like a terribly long, dense narrative of it. Like I was just posting about it on Twitter a few minutes ago. In fact, like I still have no fucking idea what that song's about at all. But it rocks and it makes me feel something.
It's a great song.
I guess I just mentioned that one for listeners. It stands out because of kind of the scarcity, but I have other songs. But Sam, do you have any?
Well, you know, I'm obsessed with the second the take two of When He Returns. It's on here with the like staccato piano.
That is I wanted to talk about that too. So I'm glad you mentioned it. That the take two of When He Returns, like, just if anybody, it's really like a bullet in the head of anybody who's like Bob Dylan's a bad singer.
Because that's like, what I think
that
too.
First second of it, I mean, it's soaring vocals. He's great.
Yeah.
The iron hand, it ain't no match, by the iron rod. The strongest wall will crumble and fall to a mighty God. For all those who have eyes, and for all those who have ears, it is only He that can reduce me to tears. Don't you cry, don't you die, and don't you.
Yeah, it's I was joking about it when I was listening to it like every like 10 minutes the other day and on Twitter, and I was like, you know, like Bob's famous thing is like, actually I hit all the notes and I can hold my breath longer than Caruso if I had to. It's like that song, it's like clearly, yeah. I mean, like he hits all the notes and he those like long sustained. I just think that song, like, it's a classic gospel song. It's totally believable. Like, when Matt and I were talking about this the other night, like, we were reading from that Christopher Ricks book, about the lyrics. Mm-hmm. It's called, like, Bob Dylan's Visions of Sin or something. Mm-hmm. And he says something like, Bob's Christian music asks to be believed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that, like, there's a relationship in it between, like, only a potential blasphemer can sing a believable Christian song.
Sure.
Because if belief is the possibility of blasphemy, and if there's no possibility, then it's not. it's not. There's no risk.
Yeah, you're making a choice.
Yeah, and so, but that song is just like, I just find it to be, there is an interesting irony in a lot of these songs, and a kind of where is he in relation to what he's saying. But in that performance, just like, it's so pure, it's so good.
Yeah.
It has like my favorite, even just like vocal flourish on the box set, which is when he says, "In an unknown hour."
That's the kind of Lou flourish there. Yeah.
Uh-huh. It's so good.
Reed vibe.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it's different. I mean, the real main difference from the record is like the way the piano. I forget who the piano player is on it. We figured that out the other night, but
It's not Bob.
It's just this like snappy, like staccato thing.
dun, dun, dun,
dun, dun, dun, dun, dun, dun, dun. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But well, you know, it might be worth saying. One of the things I wanted to talk about some, and I think When He Returns is the perfect kind of way into it, is like Bob's apocalyptic imagination and the end time stuff. Because one of the things that was big, especially in the Vineyard Christian Fellowship circles he was in, was this book that was published in 1970 by Hal Lindsey, The Late Great Planet Earth, which was like sort of a book about the end times. And this is the kind of thing I mentioned earlier, like the fundamentalist Christianity I grew up with, the end time stuff was huge. And like the way it's very, if I can put it this way, the way we fundamentalist Baptists read the book of Revelation was very Talmudic.
Like
looking for
numerology. Like, and...
Yes. And so, but this was big in the Vineyard Christian circles Bob was in. And even I went back and I read some of the book today. And it's so fascinating, given that Bob, of course, is Jewish, you know, by birth, that the whole beginning of The Late Great Planet Earth is about the Hebrew prophets. And like, it's about Isaiah and Jeremiah and Micah. And like, and really, like, a lot of the Christian end time stuff is about reading these, you know, prophets from the Hebrew Bible / Old Testament, you know, one thing fundamentalist Christianity does is read things literally. So there's like no difference between like these Old Testament texts and the Book of Revelation, and it's all like can be interpolated and, you know, read alongside each other and juxtaposed. And so, like, the end time stuff was huge. And like, when you see Bob, like, in the Toronto shows in 1980, like, giving these riffs before the songs about, like, Gog and Magog, that's, like, right from Hal Lindsey's late great Planet Earth. Gog was Russia and Magog was Iran, and there would be a conflict in the Middle East that would,
also,
like,
right from
that would lead to him to like, bring things full circle, him returning, meaning Jesus Christ,
right,
returning as king.
Uh-huh. Yeah, of every earthly plan that is known to man, he is unconcerned. He's got plans of his own to set up his throne when he returns.
Yes. Yeah,
there's also that Allen Ginsberg bit about Gog Magog that, like, he I don't know if you're familiar with that. He has a poem where he says that a lot.
Yeah,
it's
the same stew.
Even to Sam's point, again, going back to like the soundtrack to the. Never happened second Jimmy Carter term, you know, in the like political, the way it's hard to pigeonhole some of this politically is I was very shocked when I, because Hal Lindsey's someone who later on I would associate with a more right-wing evangelicalism, but like he begins his book, The Late Great Planet Earth, by saying, we all really are uncertain about the future. Like overpopulation. Okay, that's bad. Like no one.
Well, that's the main concern that everyone has
but,
now.
But then, you know? Then he was like nuclear war and air and water pollution. Like, can the human race continue to exist? Like, there's nothing about it when you start reading it that makes you think this is right wing crazy politics.
Overly,
yeah.
Sure. Well, of course. I mean, these days, I don't think it's far from anybody's mind that the end times are nigh.
Everything's going great. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And of course, the 80s,
the
with
Biden
all the Cold
boom.
War stuff, you know, because Reagan believed in the end times stuff too, you know, and so
but we all believe in the end times now. Right?
But it was really like in the air in the 80s, because it's like, oh, the mark of the beast. What's that on Gorbachev's forehead? Right. like there was a lot of weird stuff in the air. And well, some of it was apocalyptic, and Bob was, you know, that like the apocalyptic end time stuff was a major feature of the Vineyard Christian Fellowship he was a part of.
I've never made this connection before, but, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s was a huge boom time of like post-punk music, and much of that was about the anxiety and the terror existentially of potential annihilation by nuclear war. Mm-hmm. One of the best records from that era about that is Deceit by This Heat, which is like this really intense British magnum opus about nuclear war. And that was like a foundational record for me and some other friends I had like growing up, and it strikes me that like this is Dylan's response to that climate is to address this kind of existential terror with some kind of immediate reaction that is in his case a religious one rather than one that's just ideological or philosophical. Mm-hmm.
That's one of the other most unique like hallmarks, I think, of his songwriting at this moment in time. Obviously, like the most unique one is he's talking about Jesus Christ. That's, you know, that's pretty clear. But never, I think, in his entire discography before or after this, is he so clearly speaking about like current events and contemporary events. Like, I don't know if you guys caught all the mentions of like Iran and the sheiks and Russia and stuff. Like, it's like, you know, he's a guy before and after this. He likes to stay far away from, you know, whatever's going on.
What about Union Sundown? You're forgetting about Neighborhood Bully.
Well, that's
part of this era.
That's part of this era, exactly.
Yeah, but you're forgetting about the earlier stuff, too. Like when he would make those songs when he was a little guy, talking about like the communist, you know, making fun of the Red Scare.
Once he got past that, you know, that was a mode of songwriting and cultural criticism, we could say, that he really dropped for the rest of his career. Except for just this, like 79 to 83, kind of time.
That's so important because it's like the thing about the folk era stuff was that that was an idiom of a certain kind of like 30s communist song.
Right.
That was like the Woody Allen, like labor, like wobbly.
Woody
song.
Woody, I think you mean Woody Guthrie.
Oh my God. That is such a fascinating Freudian slip.
Yeah.
Well, just
like, yeah. So like yeah, so nobody. So but then at this point he goes back to like I don't know, everyone's like, you know, like the finger pointing songs, like these are finger pointing songs again too, and he's not clearly like engaged with current events, like, you know, Slow Train coming and like the you know the oil barons abroad who are controlling America.
Foreign oil controlling American soil. Look around you. It's just bound to make you embarrassed. Sheiks walking around like kings, wearing fancy jewels and nose rings, deciding America's future from Amsterdam to Paris.
Yeah, it's nuts. Another good one for this stuff is When You're Gonna Wake Up.
Yes.
And when you the version of
that's the finger pointing song to end them all, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Which one am I thinking of? There's one version of it on here that's so good. Yeah, this has like all of these references to stuff that was contemporary then. But I was also thinking like if one of these like new right populist like freaks on the right wanted to have a great campaign song, this would be a good one. Like, because there's even a line that's like, not that Bob would allow that, hopefully. But there's even the line that's like, adulterers in churches and pornography in the schools.
He was writing about grooming.
You got gangsters in power and lawbreakers making rules.
And the chorus, I thought the exact thing. It's so dark, but I did. I was like, oh, shit.
When you got to wake up and strengthen the things that remain.
Yeah, that line is one that always sticks in my craw. Strengthen the things that remain.
That's the most kind of like, that's like, that really does sound like a conservative shibboleth more than most.
Well, it is kind of objectively a conservative idea.
Yeah, you
want to
conserve the existing
conservative
things,
in the true sense. Yeah, like let's like not go, and let's not do away with the foundation of things. And that's not, of course, necessarily a bad impulse. You know, there is something to be said for like, recognizing that certain things in life ought not to be dismissed. You don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Like the gender binary, I assume you mean.
Yeah, this is what I'm talking about.
Go on, talking about bathrooms
and who can go in them. I just mean in terms of like having some kind of an anchor of like a moral and
a solid rock.
Yeah, a solid
there
rock.
There you go.
Made before solid rock? Is that what you want to hear? Solid rock made before the foundation of the earth?
You mean that one? You mean that one? Okay.
That's one of the best little snippets of Bob.
He's such a psycho at this moment.
We got a request.
Who's requesting that? Who the fuck is
it's just like nobody else has been ever calling out the songs from the Christian records, and he finally got one. He's like, did somebody say solid rock?
Someone clearly just said like, I want you, and then he's like, oh yeah, that's solid rock.
I hope that's what he said. That's what happened. He's just like, did somebody say solid rock?
When You're Gonna Wake Up also has maybe the funniest line in the entire like set, this entire era. Counterfeit philosophies have polluted all of your thoughts. Karl Marx has got you by the throat. Henry Kissinger still got you wrapped up in knots, which I think speaks perfectly to this concept that you mentioned earlier, man. Like, this doesn't fit neatly into just like hard right reactionary kind of conservatism. Yeah. He's anti. I guess it's unclear whether he's anti-Karl Marx based on the communist element or the, you know, Soviet USSR element or both or neither. But he's clearly also against Henry Kissinger.
It's also like all ideologies cloud the mind from perceiving religious truth.
And, yeah, there's no time to think.
Totally. Uh-huh.
He's got that other line about Karl Marx, the greatest enemies of mankind, on the most recent.
That's on the most recent. Yeah, that's on.
Karl Marx again.
And your boy Freud, I think, right?
Freud and Marx, yeah.
Yeah, perfect.
Does he say anything about Woody Allen? Steering clear.
I beg
he's
you
so
not to bring
correct.
Woody Allen up.
You know, he just won't. He just won't address the whole Woody Allen yeah. situation.
Don't but, get.
You
know, do not get Evan me. Started on Woody Allen.
Yeah. But it, you know, it's not to delve into like questions of anti-Semitism, like Marx and Kissinger juxtaposed like that. But I will say when I was like a teenager, I was in a Sunday school class on the Book of Revelation, kind of the end times. Truly, I'm not making any of this up. And I remember this old lady in the class raised her hand and she said, "Do you think Henry Kissinger is the Antichrist?" And like now, I like
she's more correct than she knew.
Yeah, but I was like, I'm like, yeah, Henry Kissinger is pretty evil.
When he's 130 years old, we're gonna be like, hey, yeah, probably was.
But it's like interesting, like in the context of this end time stuff, like the Trilateral Commission, the UN, like there's a lot that was like I was kind of taught growing up that like probably the Antichrist would be, if not the Pope. Then probably the Secretary General of the UN.
Damn, I have no idea why. Yeah.
You need someone who can like pull a lot of strings all over the world. So, but that's all.
And because the war to end all wars has to start. There has to be a uniting of all the nations first, right?
The Antichrist will gather many people together, but. That's also a way of saying I think my parents hate that I'm Catholic more than they hate that I'm gay. Believe it or not, that's the worst offense.
That's so funny. I mean, I don't know. There's so many lines from so many of these songs. Like he's all over the place. I don't know if you guys caught this.
Give us some more, Ian.
We should talk a little bit about the. Yeah. Sort of shot of love stuff and how that fits into this because
okay can I just say it
please
what's you three's take on Lenny Bruce
great brilliant song
they stamped him and they labeled him like they do with pants and shirts
good song
I thought you guys hated Lenny Bruce
but what's its significance,
so much older than we're younger than that now.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh.
Sorry, I don't mean to retread any ground you covered.
We're always happy to talk about Lenny Bruce. This is a Lenny Bruce podcast.
Because I don't have a take on it. And I just wondered what your take is like on that album. Because, you know, Shot of Love's interesting because it is the third. And then, you know, of the trilogy, ostensibly the final, I subscribe, as you seem to, into the long Christian period from Street right. Legal to Infidels. But, like, properly speaking, it's the last Christian album,
right?
Like, in one sense. And to me, Shot of Love is also kind of the weirdest of the Christian albums.
Yeah.
And its presence on it just has always been, like, super interesting to me, especially given that Bob himself, you know, was born Jewish. And
right.
that's part of his background. And on this Christian album... You know, there's this Lenny Bruce song, and I don't have well developed thoughts on it, but I'm interested in everyone.
I think that the interesting contradiction is like you'd think that it shows that he's coming out of this hyper evangelist era, and he's incorporating more of the world outside of that, more of the secular,
or even his
Jewishness.
Again. Like, look at the album art to right, Infidels, yeah. right? Like, he's in Jerusalem.
Yep.
Yes. So I think that Lenny Bruce represents a sort of integration, reintegration into the world outside the secular world after this very intense initial foray into Christianity.
He's going back to the Old Testament. He's done with the New Testament shit. Yeah, he's going back to the Old Testament.
Lenny Bruce is, I think, a song ultimately about like someone who he fancies is sort of like him. And it's, I think, echoed in Roll On John, a song that gets so much shit also, like Lenny Bruce also just like gets shit on by everyone. But both these songs are, I think, songs where he's writing about someone he kind of has like a feeling of a brothership with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Bob has always been very like appreciative of like entertainers. I think you get this sense from watching some of the documentaries and stuff, like the Scorsese documentary.
He's just a ton of time.
Yeah, he spends a ton of time talking about how formative his experience at the carnival in Hibbing was as a kid, And right. so I think Lenny Bruce is right there in that kind of legacy of just like people who went up on stage and
Buddy
entertained
Holly.
People. Yeah. And he did it his way. Bob does it his way, you know, which is a different way. And so I think that like the, it's almost a coincidence that it occurs on this Christian record, you know, this song about this dead Jew.
You know, it's funny though that which
is how the song begins, right? Lenny Bruce
written
is
a song.
Dead.
In the Chronicles, other... he talks about Gorgeous George. Like, there's this really weird part where he talks about Gorgeous
George. Yeah, like
the
strong man, exactly.
Walks in, and it's one of the most remarkable parts of that whole book. And it's similar to this thing of Lenny Bruce, of like this moment of he must have been in a taxi with him, and it just left this huge impression. He was also in a fucking taxi or the back of a car with John Lennon, as is documented in Eat the Document.
Uh-huh. Right.
And then, but this moment with Gorgeous George, where he says that he walked in, he was like glowing with all his full regalia, and it was like this thing of just seeing someone we've only known from pictures, and that it seemed to him that as he was playing, Gorgeous George looked at him and said, "You're making it come alive." Literally mouthed those words. And he said that gave me the confidence and strength for like a long time after.
It's all thanks to Gorgeous George, the greatest legacy of pop music in the American canon.
And then also the moment of him seeing Buddy Holly play when he was just a kid, seeing Buddy Holly like a few weeks or months before he died,
yeah.
And having this moment of alleged eye contact with Buddy Holly, and these moments of these kind of like contact with certain kind of heroic figures to him seem to punctuate his life. Mm-hmm. So that's what Lenny Bruce is. It's one of those moments where he's honoring one of these, like, these soul connections. Uh-huh.
American entertaining
archetype.
He
did that at every show of the tour, right? The last tour, where he said, this might be how we identify which show we were at in New York, because I was at the show where he said, Sylvester Stallone's from New York.
You were the Stallone one.
The 21st, I think.
And that. He said that Rambo Last Blood should have won an Oscar.
Right. Uh-huh. I was only at the one where he shouted out Melville, unfortunately.
Too bad.
Yeah. Anyways, Shot of Love material. Yeah. Insane stuff, uh-huh. because he is re-secularizing to some extent with some of this uh-huh. stuff. But also, uh-huh. like, there are just some insane, yes. like, apocalyptic visions of the world, particularly the title track and Dead Man, Dead Man.
And Groom Still Waiting at the Altar,
yeah. All of which are just, like, incredibly dense and, like, kind uh-huh. of edgy and harsh. Yeah. Like, that feels like end times kind of music. The glamour and the bright lights and the politics uh-huh. of sin, the ghetto that you build for me is the one you're living in, the race of the engine that overrules your heart. Ooh, I can't stand it. Pretending you're just so smart. Dead man. Like, you know, I don't really know what he's fucking talking about there, but he's clearly very angry about something.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too. I mean, to keep on Shot of Love, as like a young conservative Christian, I adored Every Grain of Sand.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and you know, like sometimes I think when it comes to Bob and like his Christian era, you like certain questions come to mind, like, well, like, how sincere was it, right? Because we know Bob's a bit of a joker man, and right, like kind of always fucking with people a little bit. But that kind of song totally passed the smell test for me as like a young Christian. It's so the tenderness of it, because this is like Every Grain of Sand. You know, it's taken from like biblical imagery of like God knowing, counting every hair on our head,
right?
Like knowing every grain of sand on the beach, like these intimate details about creaturely existence, you know. And so like in terms of favorite songs from this era, and even on this box set, the live version of Every Grain of Sand from Florida in November 81 is just like, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible.
But you know, so like Shot of Love's interesting precisely because it's where some of the songs that I felt most profoundly connected to as like a young religious person were there. But it's also the album with Lenny Bruce and like the kind of reorient himself a little bit towards, you know, what would come next.
Well, I think it's that he's he's not abandoning Christianity. It's that he is.
I don't think he ever really out did. Of
this. No, he didn't. I don't think either. And I think that we've talked about this before, but that it's what he's done is kind of, I guess, figured out a way to like integrate it into just into what he does and who he is.
Yeah, he's not exclusively doing Christian shit. He's just, this is a new flavor that he's blending into the overall kind of picture. And you even see that with the live sets, right? Like, there's the two live sets on this this set, this whole box set. There's
he's closing with Every Grain of Sand these days.
Well, he's of course. You know, as we've covered, you know, one of his greatest songs ever. But the first live set here, right, the live in Toronto, is 100% Christian shit. That's 79 or 80, I forget. And then the second one, live in London, Earl's Court, is 81, and he's half and half. He's doing the Christian shit, but he's also doing just absolutely like burning hot versions of Rolling Stone and Maggie's Farm.
Yeah, that's important to know, is that the end of this box set includes a lot of those familiar songs.
Mr. Tambourine Man.
And
which kind of, like, it's funny you mentioned Like a Rolling Stone from London. That was something that, like, when Sam came over Saturday night and we were drinking bourbon talking, I was like, I fucking love this version of Like a Rolling Stone. But it kind of speaks to another aspect of this era, which is just how great it was, like, the band he had playing with him. How great it was
Keltner
musically.
Is the god. Keltner.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and incredible. So it's kind of, it makes sense that even in this, like, ostensibly Christian era, towards the end of it, when he's mixing up a little more, when his set lists are not exclusively Christian, but he has this amazing band. Like, all those classics from the London set, I kind of think are amazing, including Like a Rolling Stone. Maybe most spectacular,
I think, especially
Rolling Stone,
Like a Rolling Stone.
Yeah, but they all are kind of great.
Talked about that specifically before, but that Like a Rolling Stone in this context, in this era, you realize how paper thin the separation is from that to this religious fervor of talking about sin, talking about, like, you're wasting your life if you're not living in the Lord. Like, he's basically saying that without knowing that he's saying it on Like a Rolling Stone. You're living your life frivolously. You are throwing something away.
He has the same kind of insights with Like a Rolling Stone that he does on, like, Precious Angel, for instance. But, like, with the Christian shit at this point, he has, like, some scaffolding behind him that, like, allows him to explain, like, this is why I can, you know, talk shit on you for being an asshole, basically.
Which is not, we should take some time to say, not always a good look, Bob.
No, it's not always a good look. No, I know. That's what's funny about it. Like, I mean, all the things that we're saying are true. It's also, like, the thing about the Christian idiom, or at least especially the kind of accusatory evangelical idiom, it still allows him to be, like, superior to somebody that he's just, like,
he loves
shitting
doing
on.
That.
And he loves being, like, just really angry at somebody.
It goes between
for not living up to his expectations,
totally selfless, and then also selfless in a way that's like kind of like, you don't even have, it's telling other people they don't have a self.
That's what makes a song like When He Returns so effective on the original record, and where it, like, at the end of that record, it's just like, it's stark, it's Bob, it's the piano, it's so quiet, and it's this really kind of generous kind of song lyrically. Totally. And it hits so much harder coming on the end of this entire record, where he's just like, he's really fire and brimstone, just like torching everyone around him, personal relationships, the world in general, himself. You know, it's a really nice kind of switch up, you know, in terms of his focus and sequencing. We haven't talked too much about the saved material yet, which is kind of like right in between Shot of Love and Slow Train. It's almost kind of the forgotten stepchild, I think, of these three.
It is. Uh-huh.
Although it has not been the forgotten stepchild on this podcast. Evan once gave it a perfect 3-star rating on the program. But you know, some of the songs on there, like Pressing On,
is incredible.
One of my like top 10 like all time ever Bob songs.
The secular, the religious shit.
Like it's just like an all time like incredible.
The Toronto version of that is also just
I was gonna ask Ian or Evan, Sam, any of you, which version you liked? Because Sam, my favorite was the Toronto one because I just think the Toronto has like the manic energy and the like knowing the context, listening to a lot of the Toronto stuff, I love that version of Pressing On. Disc 6 of the deluxe box
disc
set.
Disc
6 of like 9 or something.
I mean, if you were expecting us to go really full on with this, I'm sorry. There's no way that we could actually touch on everything.
And that's the great version, too, from I'm Not There. Like that's kind of the song, right? That is highlighted in the Christian Bale.
Oh, you mean the one that John Christian Bale sings.
John Doe sings it, and Christian Bale performs it.
So I guess you know I it's always been especially associated with Bob's Christian phase for me because of that movie.
Yeah.
And the version on the soundtrack is amazing. It's amazing on the movie. Yeah. Bob's versions are all amazing, but the Toronto version to me has that kind of. I don't know. That great band with him, that great atmosphere from the Toronto shows.
There's a real sense of drama in that.
Yeah, that's the version from the box
It's a deeply dramatic song. That song, I mean, if we're going to end on talking about a song here, because we've gone quite long, I would say, but I think that this is the best song to send it off with about this era, because it really encompasses everything about what's great about this period for Dylan. And it also like hints at everything that will come after.
Right.
And it really does say something. It's religious, you know, the higher calling of my Lord, but it's what that means is big enough that it can mean a lot of things.
Well, there's just such crystal clear kind of imagery and like emotional kind of, insight in here the same way that there is with Grain of Sand. Many try to stop me, try to shake up my mind. They say, prove to me that he's Lord, show me a sign. How can he give a sign for experience within when what's lost has been found, what's to come has already been? Like that line gets me every single fucking time, and that's different than it actually is on the record. He switches it up in some of these live performances on this set, but that last couplet, when he's lost, when what's lost has been found, what's to come has already been, is just always like, man, gets me.
This is totally. Really just soul nourishing music. Like I don't care who you are, this is just like if you come to this without like any idea about what you want from Bob Dylan, like you just watch this person on the stage with this band and these backup singers singing this song about just moving forward through life, through hardship, and forging ahead with some kind of purpose. That is, that's in the truest and most profound sense, good music.
And I mean, my personal favorite lyrics from Pressing On are the shake the dust off your feet and don't look back.
Which
is a direct quote from the Gospels, Jesus' instruction to his disciples.
Where have I heard that before?
And as someone who recently quit his job, like I have to admit, shake the dust off your feet and don't look back was like, that line was like echoing in my mind a lot lately.
Hell yeah. Well,
so yeah. Glad you quit your job, Matt.
I am too.
Everybody, congrats. A round of applause for
Bravo.
Matt.
That's That's what we are working towards ourselves, so that we can make our livings talking podcasting. To our friends on the computer. Yeah.
That's what I tell everyone. It's like I have one coworker. His name's Sam Adler Bell. For better or worse,
It could be worse.
It could be worse. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, thank you guys so much for hopping on with us. I mean, we didn't get to the bottom of this because it's literally eight and a half hours long. But there's spirit.
Yeah, I have so many more songs to talk about. But I agree that Pressing On is a great one to close out on.
Yeah,
this version is so good. I have it in my right ear. It is
my
it is
right
so
ear.
Great.
You still can't figure out how to get your headphones to play music.
You know, it's also a great song to close on, because one of the YouTube clips of Dylan singing Pressing On, it's great. He's like finishes the song and like is waving to the audience and, you know, like walking around the stage and then leaves. It was like, wow.
Yeah,
he just walks off. It's what he walked out from.
Wow.
You know, and it's like, you know, it's true of all great performers. You gotta leave the stage while the music's still playing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
On that note,
How many stars do we give the Lord Jesus Christ? Three stars for me.
Yeah, three stars for the Lord. Three stars
out of what?
Out of three. It's a three-star system.
I definitely give Jesus Christ three.
Okay.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah.
God also three. And the Holy Ghost also three.
a holy trinity of three-star rankings.
I was going to say, it'd be a little weird to be like, God the Father, 3.0. Jesus Christ, you put out Holy Spirit, 2.5.
Yeah, what's that about?
Holy Spirit,
2.5.
Not feeling it, 2.5.
This worked out so nicely.
Just like Bob, Jesus, just really a great Jew who really told some truths, some hard truths,
mm-hmm.
and so 3 stars for me too.
And was betrayed by,
the British.
Yeah, let's go with the British.
People who like gold.
Yeah, I was gonna go more in that direction. all right, thank you guys. Plug? Where can the folks follow? Our shit is way smaller than yours, but just for the Bob freaks that listen to this, where can they follow along and listen to you guys?
Know Your Enemies, available wherever you get your podcasts, and you can follow us at, well, Sam, what's our Twitter handle? At knowyourenemypod.com?
It's kind of hard. It's like YR or something, but if you just, you'll find it.
Yeah.
We'll have links in the episode description.
Yeah.
All right.
No, it'd be good if more of your listeners started listening to us so that they would encourage us to talk about Bob on the pod more, because that's all we really want to do.
Uh-huh.
talk about all these conservative freaks instead.
Well, we're glad that you are just as knowledgeable about conservative recording artist Bob Dylan as you are about Bill Buckley and Friedrich Hayek.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. This was
thank
fun.
You.
Yeah, thank
it's
you.
A lot of fun.
Thank you. Keep pressing on.
Jokerman. Pressing on.